Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. 50 years ago today, on May 5th, 1961, Alan Shepard became the first American in space, making a brief suborbital mission that marked the first manned launch of Project Mercury. That event triggered a Cold War space race with the Soviet Union and dreams of flights to the moon. Eventually, the seven Mercury astronauts would be immortalized in literature and on the big screen as men with the right stuff. Today we'll talk about the value of Project Mercury a half century later, John Glenn and the other Project Mercury astronauts, and whether continuing America's space program is a good idea. Our guest is Roger Launius. He's a senior curator at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. He focuses on the Mercury and Gemini programs. And so did these guys have the right stuff, or was that just a bunch of hype?
Well, there's a certain level of hype that's associated with it. But, yeah, they had the right stuff. I mean, they had the ability to be at the top of their game as a test pilot. They were able to take on highly risky activities and be successful at doing them. They were willing to risk their lives. And some of them, of course, in the case of Gus Grissom, did give their lives for this cause. So, yeah, they had the right stuff.
So looking back on it now, how risky was the whole Project Mercury program, the Gemini program that followed it?
That was pretty risky in a lot of ways. I mean, we were moving into this entirely new realm. Nobody knew in 1961 when Alan Shepard was launched exactly what to expect in terms of space flight. This entirely unusual environment in which humans are not adapted to survive at all. Could you even survive in a space capsule, basically a tin can that's up there protecting you in space? And they proved that you could do it. And not only do it, but succeed in doing other things beyond that.
And people forget, don't they, that the Soviets sort of beat us up there, right?
Oh, they did. The Soviets launched Yuri Gagarin on the 12th of April of that year and beat us into space by almost a month.
So we knew that a human could survive up there, at least for a short period. So what did Alan Shepard's flight teach us, and what did we learn from it?
Yeah, it's important to know that Shepard's flight was just a first step. And the idea was we're going to send them up and back down. And in part, it's a test of the Mercury spacecraft and a test of the rocket system that's going to send them up. And he was only going to be up there 15 minutes or so. He was weightless for just a very short period of time. But this was the first stage of a process of experimentation that would become more long and complex as time passed.
You know, one thing that really struck me last night, I read a long narrative about John Glenn's first flight just, a few months later. And what struck me about that story was, at least my sense looking back on it now, was it was John Glenn's flight and the thing went off flawlessly and there weren't any problems. But you read the narrative and you quickly realize there was one problem after another that had to be overcome to get that man back down to Earth safely. It was an amazing story. Why didn't – were some of those problems sort of covered up over the years, Roger, or has time just lost them to us?
Well, we've lost most of them over time. It's not that they were covered up.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly the people inside NASA knew all about it. The historians who've looked at this subject know all about it. And there's a few things that have been highlighted that are only some of the issues that he had to wrestle with. They brought him home early after three orbits. He was supposed to go for seven initially.
Mm-hmm.
And the light that was on his console and on the mission control console about his landing bag being deployed, that was a serious issue. That was one of the things that forced them to come back early.
And whether the heat shield was still on the back of the capsule or not that would protect him as he burned back down through the atmosphere, that was a big question. They weren't sure it would hold.
They weren't sure. I mean, the landing bag light is what tipped them off that there might be a problem. That landing bag was basically a big inflatable balloon that would keep the spacecraft afloat when it landed in the ocean.
Yeah.
And if it had been deployed, it was underneath the heat shield. The heat shield is supposed to pop off when it reaches the ocean and this bag come out. But if it's already deployed and he's in orbit, that means that the heat shield is detached. That was the real concern.
And then we could have had real problems with John Glenn. Then the whole story could have been different.
Well, I tell you, I mean, if it had actually been a problem, they could have lost him, and that would have been tragic, and certainly would have set us back a long way.
Well, you've gotten to know some of the Mercury astronauts over the year. John Glenn is still with us. Did he talk much about that, how shaky that reentry was on that flight and how close things came to going completely awry?
Well, he'll tell you that he was confident that it was just a malfunction of the electrical system, which is actually what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks on the ground at Mission Control thought that as well, but they didn't want to take any chances. I mean, this is the first American orbital mission. We aren't sure what's going to happen. And consequently, they wanted to be very, very careful. But it was he wasn't really ever in much danger from that particular aspect of it. But the whole process of coming back to Earth was a difficult experience for anybody in splashdowns.
Yeah.
Lots of G's. You're dangling at the bottom of a parachute. And then you hit the water pretty hard.
Yeah. And he saw the water coming. He talks about that and thought, I got to brace myself. And he did smack it. Really.
That's right.
And once he hit it, Roger, he had to sit there for 15, 17 minutes until the cruiser came to pick him up. He was baking inside that capsule.
That's right. It was very, very hot. And they figure out ways to solve that problem with the Mercury capsule after that particular flight. But he was sitting there in plus 100 degree temperature from all of the stuff of coming back through the atmosphere and the friction associated with reentry.
Those guys, those Mercury astronauts, always struck me as larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really mythologized over the years in American culture. What were they like in real life? You got to know them.
Well, I got to know some of them, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And, I knew them, of course, later in life. They were all young men during this particular era. They had a lot of young men attributes. They were outgoing. They were effervescent. They liked to drink. They liked women.
Yeah.
They liked to drive fast. They liked
yeah.
to fly. All of those things are true about them.
Except for John Glenn.
And John Glenn, well, he liked to drive fast, and he liked and he liked other aspects of it. He did not chase women.
Did they all become rich men as a result?
All of them became comfortable. And mm-hmm. I don't know that any of them were really wealthy in the overall sense of the term. Most of them came out of the military services, and they were used to a military pay system. So they weren't wealthy individuals to start with, but their notoriety allowed them to be engaged in other economic activities later. Most of them didn't see much in the way of an income until after they'd left the astronaut corps.
There's an interesting story about how these guys were picked. You know, NASA wanted to comb through the ranks of industry and the military services mm-hmm. for astronaut candidates. But I think it was President Eisenhower who came out and decided that the pool of military test pilots who were already there was a big enough pool. And he said, that's the pool we're going to draw from. So how were the astronauts finally picked? How were the seven picked out of that pool?
Yeah, it was an interesting story. I mean, the reality is NASA actually started the process by advertising that we're looking for astronauts. And so if you fit these priorities, they were able to apply for that particular process. They combed through the records from the military services. They were looking for test pilots, people who had test flight experience. And based upon that, they found about 130 or so possible candidates. Then they ascertained whether or not these people were interested in undertaking this activity. Some dropped off. But by about by that time, they had probably 60 or so, and they had some preliminary medical tests. They did some reviews of their records. They sent a select number of them out to the Lovelace Clinic in Albuquerque, where there was a whole series of tests that that most of the Mercury 7 astronauts referred to as torture as they tried to determine whether or not they would be acceptable for space flight. And then based upon that, they were going to select six. They couldn't get the number down to six, and finally they ended up with seven.
What were the torturous aspects of some of the things they went through? What were they forced to endure?
Everybody will tell you, and this is still true to some extent. I mean, they are poked and prodded in ways that none of us really enjoy.
And the right stuff, the movies sort of show.
They show it
that,
as a comedy routine in the film,
mm-hmm.
and there's certainly a sense of that that's present. As you're engaged in isolation experiments, you're engaged in tests of muscles, tests of high altitude endurance, all kinds of other things. And as I said, blood's taken all the time. All kinds of other things are tested as well.
Roger Launius is our guest. He's a senior curator at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. That's the most what? The most popular museum on the face of the earth?
Yes, we never get tired of saying that.
But even more than the Louvre and everything else?
Yeah, that's correct, in the world. And we're very proud of that. I should tell you, it sometimes changes back and forth. Sometimes it's us, sometimes it's the Louvre, sometimes it's somebody else. But we're always right up there.
When people come to your museum, what are the most popular aspects of it? I always think of the grand entryway when you come in and you see the capsules and the Lindbergh plane and everything else. And is that the most popular part of the museum?
That is without a doubt the most popular part. It's called the Milestones of Flight Gallery.
That's right.
And it starts with all of these icons of air and space in the United States. So we've got the Spirit of St. Louis that Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic. We've got the John Glenn space capsule that he flew in 1962. We've got
which seems tiny.
It is tiny.
You
I mean, it is
outside,
stunning
how small
this
is.
Thing is.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. He got through it with just that little
right.
And that little thing. What else is really popular there?
The other part is we have a whole gallery that's dedicated to the Wright brothers, and so we have the Wright Flyer in there, the first airplane that ever flew, and that's very, very popular.
How did the Smithsonian get that plane?
It's a long story.
I bet.
It's fascinating because, of course, the Smithsonian existed when the Wrights flew in 1903. But the head of the Smithsonian at the time was a fellow by the name of Samuel Langley, who was engaged in his own tests to try to fly. And he got money from the War Department, the predecessor to the Department of Defense, to undertake this activity. And he tried to fly just a few weeks before the Wrights were successful. He was unsuccessful. His airplane, which was launched on a catapult from a houseboat in the Potomac River, it had the most beautiful crash about 2 seconds after flight you've ever seen. And because of Langley's efforts to try to fly before the Wrights, the Smithsonian was protecting him, and they were unwilling for the longest time to admit that the Wrights had been first. And it so ticked off the Wright brothers that they refused to give the airplane to the Smithsonian. They shipped it to the British Museum, and it was on display there until 1948.
Oh, my gosh.
Through World War II. And when the deal was made with Orville Wright, who was the last of the Wrights to survive, that before he died, he had it sent back to the Smithsonian, but only after the Smithsonian had said, in no uncertain terms, yes, indeed, the Wright brothers were the first to fly. Langley was unsuccessful. And okay, so now you can have the airplane.
Well, that's quite a story.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this whole idea, the space program sort of being, at least at this moment, Roger, at this pivot point, mm-hmm. do we continue it? Do we not? What do we want out of it? Should we proceed or not? What do you think the future of America's space program is at this point?
Yeah, I'm more optimistic than some folks are.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that people understand that when we talk about the space program, there's several pieces to it. One is the human spaceflight program, which is the one that is at a crossroads. The others, the planetary science program, the exploration of the universe, things like Hubble Space Telescope.
Those things are ongoing.
Those are ongoing and no problem at all. Earth science continues without any real significant change, and so does aeronautics research. NASA's engaged in a lot of activities to build better airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
But the human part of this is the one that everyone is focused on, because the shuttle's now going to be retired after 30 years of service. And it's time to do so. I mean, it's time to give the shuttle an honorable retirement. It's had a very good run. It's done its job very well. There's been some tragedies, of course, with the two accidents, but there's been remarkable successes as well. But then what's next?
Yeah. What is next?
It's still uncertain. But one of the things that happened was that last year the president announced that we would retire the shuttle as had been intended, and that we would move toward a commercial capability to fly astronauts up into low Earth orbit to the International Space Station. We have this space station that's up above us about 240 miles, and it's engaged in all kinds of things. There's a crew of six aboard it. A lot of people don't even realize
it's
there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
what are they doing up there?
There's all kinds of experimentation underway. You wouldn't believe the number of things that are coming out of this kinds of research. And it
like
has
what?
To do with microgravity, materials processing, biomedical. other types of experimentation in a whole variety of ranges.
Mm-hmm. I thought the next step was going to be, do we go to Mars or not? That was sort of where I thought we were headed.
There's a lot of people who'd like to do that, and ultimately we probably will, but it's not going to happen anytime in the near term. We're probably going to spend the next decade doing work on the space station. And then at some point down the road, as there's a new capability to go beyond, and this is one of the things that NASA's focused on now, is if we can buy rides on a commercial vehicle, which is where we'd like to go, to the space station, that frees up NASA from investing dollars to do that kind of work into deep space activities, doing the R&D necessary to get off this planet, to go to the moon, to go to Mars, to go to L2, to go to asteroids, wherever it happens to be. And that's kind of the focus that the agency's taking now.
How long do you think it'll be before we decide to go to Mars and actually make an attempt to get there?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I would see us go back to the moon before we'd go to Mars, simply because it's a very good stepping stone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things we still have to learn before we're going to undertake long deep space missions. I mean, we're talking about a year plus to go to Mars and back.
Just in travel time, you're saying?
Yeah, basically.
Wait, 6 months to get there?
Six months could be eight. It depends on the trajectory and exactly when you launch. But a minimum of about 6 months to get there using our existing technologies. If we build something different that's more powerful, then maybe a little bit less time. But it's still going to be a long way.
I mean, the problem is we've been to the moon. That doesn't strike me as really sexy. What do we gain by trying to go to Mars? If we're able to do it, what do we learn from Mars that we don't get from the moon?
Yeah, there's this huge debate that's taking place in the space world between the groups that I like to refer to as the lunatics and the Martians. And
Which side are you on?
I'm actually on the moon side, but simply because I think we can see that in the near term more readily than a Mars mission. But and they both have pros and cons. There's no one right answer here. Going to the moon provides some interesting possibilities that we didn't know about in 1969 and 70.
Such as what?
The fact that there's probably water there or ice.
Mm-hmm.
And our robotic probes have demonstrated that there's probably ice at the poles in deep craters that never see the sun. So if we've got ice there, that means if we can figure out a way to get there, we can mine that ice, we can create water immediately. We can break it down into oxygen and hydrogen, which allows us to breathe and also to have a fuel with the hydrogen. Hmm. And that is just an enormous new capability to do something there. So that's something that makes that exciting. Beyond that, the folks who want to go to Mars say, you know, been there, done that in terms of the moon. Fair enough. And there's all of these really enticing things about Mars, like the possibility that there probably was life there at one time in the past, and searching for evidence of that, and maybe even life currently there. I mean, we don't know.
Why do we think life used to be there, perhaps?
Well, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there was water there, that water flowed freely on Mars, and water is the fundamental building block of life as we understand it, carbon-based life.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was there, was it there long enough that maybe life evolved? There's also people who have speculated that perhaps there were meteorites from Mars that had some form of organic material on them that seeded Earth, and the life that exists here evolved out of the Mars life.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of fascinating things to look at, which we don't know the answers to, and they may not prove out, but we'll never know unless we look.
Do you think that the water that's on the ice on the, that's on the moon, is that going to be drinkable?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, if you've got ice, you can purify it. You probably would have to purify it. That would enable you then to use it in all kinds of ways. You can make potable water. You can do all kinds of other things with it in terms of breaking it down to its individual compounds.
Yeah. Roger Launius is our guest. We're talking about the Mercury and Gemini programs. Should we continue to spend $19 billion a year on NASA, Sean writes. An emphatic yes. I'd like to see the total doubled, tripled, even the science and engineering coming out of NASA could save our species and our planet. He writes that on our Facebook page. he's pretty high on it.
Well, I think he's right about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the $18 billion in change that we're talking about, that's the NASA budget today, is minuscule.
Mm-hmm.
It's less than 0.5% of the federal budget. So, I mean, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny amount. I believe that, you know, we could double that easily and make it, say, 1% of the federal budget, and that would be this marvelous investment in the future.
But it seems like, you know, the excitement and some of the imagination that sort of got us all fired up back in the 60s and 70s, so much of that now seems gone. And
yeah.
I'm not sure exactly why that is. We've done the moon, as in people think, well, we've sort of done it. What about that?
Yeah, there is an excitement malaise that does exist in a lot of things that we're engaged in. But I think that's partly because we've been doing the same sorts of things over and over again. So we recognize when a shuttle flight takes place, and we pause maybe for a minute to watch the launch. But after that, we go back to our everyday lives. That activity is no longer newsworthy in the same way that every single launch during that heroic era of the 60s.
And that's because why? It was new then. It's old now.
It was new then. It was new then. It was, and we all recognize it as such, risky then. And so everybody kind of paused to watch to see what was going to happen.
And we used to hang on those flights. And
oh, yeah.
What was going on every day in school? You knew
right.
what was happening
right.
to those guys.
Yeah, and that's a real thing. But even those missions got a little boring to people. I mean, by the time of Apollo 13 and the famous film that was done in the mid-1990s that Tom Hanks was in, Apollo 13, talks about this. Until they had the accident, nobody cared. They mm-hmm. watched the launch. They were supposed to have a broadcast on their way to the moon, which they did, but nobody carried it live because it just wasn't newsworthy from their perspective any longer. So even in those days, it becomes, after you do it a few times, it's no longer new, different, and newsworthy.
Okay, well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with the senior curator at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, Roger Launius. We'll talk about how technology has changed these space vehicles and the Cold War space race. How did the space race advance each country's military might? I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. This hour, we're visiting with Roger Launius. He's a senior curator at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum about the history of the space program and its future. Roger, Mercury wasn't an out-of-the-blue project, was it? I mean, the U.S. had been looking at rocket development and space flight since the early 1950s. Was there one particular breakthrough that started the ball rolling toward manned space flight?
Well, there's a whole series of things that took place, but it's important to know that people were seriously thinking and working on the idea of human spaceflight going back at least to the first part of the 20th century.
Hmm.
They always thought it was going to be a space plane, that you're going to fly a vehicle that has wings into space and come back and land like an airplane. That's the dominant thinking all the way through until the space race begins in the 1950s. And suddenly, during Sputnik, in October of 1957, when the Soviet Union demonstrates that they can put an orbital satellite up, we change our concept. And the capsule, which was modeled on a ballistic missile warhead, mm-hmm. interestingly enough, you replace the nuke with an astronaut, is the dominant way in which they do this particular activity all through the 1960s. But NASA never abandoned the idea of a space plane. And the shuttle is the result of that.
How competitive was the race between this country and the Soviets?
It was very competitive, and the Russians were winning.
Mm-hmm.
They basically beat us with the first orbital satellite. They beat us with the first living thing to go into space, like a
chimp. Yeah.
The dog. Actually.
The dog first.
Yeah.
Okay.
We did chimps, and they did dogs.
That's right. That's right.
But they beat us with the first mission to reach the moon. They beat us with the first pictures of the backside of the moon. They beat us with the first human, Yuri Gagarin, into space. They beat us with the first 2-person crew. They beat us with the first 3-person crew. They beat us with the first woman, with Valentina Tereshkova in 1963. On and on and on. All through that late 50s, early 1960s, they were winning.
How did this country react to that, Roger?
We didn't like it very much.
And
the idea, and this is how, and this was the reason why John Kennedy pursued a strategy that was aimed at basically leapfrogging the Russians and taking us to the moon. And that's why just we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of his famous speech in 20 days about let's go to the moon mm-hmm. on the 25th of May of this year, in which he says we're going to do it by the end of the decade. And that was going to leapfrog those technologies that the Russians had to put us to the moon.
Why weren't the Russians more interested in beating us to the moon?
Well, they were. And, mm-hmm. and right up till the very end, they thought that maybe they could steal the march on us. In 1968, at the time of the Apollo 8 circumlunar flight, they tested a vehicle called Zond, and they flew it in the fall of that year to the moon unmanned. Their idea was that maybe they could put a cosmonaut aboard that thing and do the same mission a few weeks later and beat us to the moon.
Huh. But what happened?
They were never successful in getting it to work properly, and the biggest problem with a landing mission for them was they couldn't build the big launcher. They had a rocket called the N1 they were trying to perfect, and it failed every time.
Hmm. Let's go to some phone calls here and go to John from Atchison. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is this. Have we learned anything on the International Space Station about protecting astronauts from radiation? Because I understand that's one of the great risks of travel to Mars and other destinations.
Great question. We have learned some things. We've already known quite a lot about how to do this. And radiation, obviously, is something that we've been wrestling with since the beginning of the nuclear age.
Is this from the sun or?
There's a natural radiation that exists. Part of it is solar flares and things of that nature. But there's also a radioactive environment that just exists in space.
Hmm.
And beyond the Van Allen radiation belts here on Earth, we have problems associated with that. There's ways to shield. We're learning more about how to do that all the time. And obviously, we don't want to lead line the spacecraft because it's just too heavy. But there's various other ways that might be done. The best way, we think, is probably to shield a spacecraft that has the astronauts in it on a trip to, say, the moon or Mars using water, thick water, which you can also drink. And that would be a method whereby we might try to do it. But there's other research underway, and we may supersede that.
And water is as good a shield as lead is?
It's not as good a shield, but it is a shield.
Huh. Interesting. Thank you, John. Larry from Lawson, Missouri. Larry, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Wonderful show today. I had a question. Not only were we in a great race with the Soviets, which probably brought out the best of all of us, and maybe we've got a new race going with the Chinese that we haven't realized yet. But what about helium-3 deposits on the moon and Buzz Aldrin's longtime interest in that as a source of hydrogen fusion?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something else I didn't mention, although I probably should have. There seems to be the existence of something that doesn't really exist naturally here on Earth, helium-3. And conceivably, we would be able to mine that on the moon and use it to create a fusion reactor to power things. That would be an enormous boon. That could be the gold rush activity that we've been thinking of. The big problem with going back to the moon is what's the driver to get us there? We've explored it already, so we've been there. And we're not sure that for pure science purposes it's worth going back. But if there's an economic benefit to it, then this might be something that would drive us. And helium-3 is potentially in that category. We need to learn more about it. We need to learn how plentiful it is there. And obviously, we need to learn how to use it.
Can we test how plentiful it is without actually sending a man to the moon? Are there ways we can test it?
There are probes that we could send that could do activities that would enable us to measure how much is there.
Mechanically, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Larry, great question. Thank you. Let's go to Brandon from Kansas City, Kansas. Brandon, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking it.
Sure.
I have more, just a couple comments that you guys hit on some pretty important topics. A very brief background. I'm a former junior high and high school science teacher. Worked for 10 summers down at the Kansas Cosmosphere and Space Center in Hutchinson. And it's, you talk about the budget, you talk about reaching the next generation, the retiring of the space shuttle. And I have gone back to school. I'm currently a PhD student at KU in geography and remote sensing. And it's sounds like from some of the topics you've discussed that that's kind of the direction we're heading and away from the human spaceflight. What do these kids that I used to teach and still work with, what do they have to look forward to?
That's a great
question. I feel like our focus has just completely been lost because it's so expensive and we've already been there, done that. But, okay, that's fine. We still fly planes, don't we?
Yeah.
I mean, we still do all these things.
So how do you light the imaginations of younger people?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And there's no question that kids are jazzed by human spaceflight. They always have been. And right up to the present.
Even today.
Oh, yeah. No question. Mm-hmm. You talk to any – just about any kid, there's a phase that they go through where they want to be an astronaut.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a good thing. Does it inspire them to go into science and math? And that's something we'd like to do. And we actually just did an exhibit at the museum. It's called Moving Beyond Earth. We're finalizing it now. But one of the things that we got in there is an interactive, kind of an electronic interactive. And it's kind of, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Mm-hmm.
And it asks you a half a dozen questions. And at the end of that, it gives you jobs that people actually do in the space program. One of those is astronaut. But the point of this is most people who are engaged in space exploration are not astronauts. They're on
right.
the ground as mission controllers or design engineers or technicians or scuba divers or scientists or some other thing. And regardless of how aggressive our human spaceflight capability is, the important thing to understand is that there is a lot of things to be done here. And most of them don't involve flying into space. At this point in time, that may change, and
mm-hmm.
I think it will. But
the
key there's
is still,
useful things to be done.
The key is still trying to find ways to fire up kids to head in that
Absolutely.
Direction, though, right?
And it's interesting to watch them because things like the Mars rovers have jazzed a whole new generation of kids that while I was a kid, you know, Apollo was the thing and watching the astronauts on the moon was a big deal. Now it's watching the rover and tuning in every day to see where it is on Mars and what it's doing.
Hmm. Brandon, I hope that helps.
Yes, it does. There's still a large part, and it's a tough fight that all of us, I think, are working towards.
I hear you.
I had kids that had never seen a space shuttle launch, and so during the day, if there was a day launch, I would pull up NASA TV online, and just the look on these kids' faces was just incredible. They're like, oh, my gosh, I didn't even know we did that.
Hmm, right.
And I mean, this whole topic, I'm very, very passionate about, as you can probably tell.
Brandon, thank you. Jamie writes us this question on KCR's Facebook page. Roger, how accurate is the movie The Right Stuff? It's always been one of my favorites, especially parts about breaking the sound barrier.
Right.
What about it?
Yeah, it's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
But we'll all agree on that. But there's a lot of license that the director and the writers took with that particular film, so much so that the Mercury 7 astronauts have refused to be involved in anything associated with it.
Does the same apply to the book? Because the book made the first man who broke the sound barrier, whose name's escaping
me. Yeah, it's Chuck Yeager.
Chuck Yeager, of
right.
course. It made him out to be this absolutely superhuman kind
right.
of guy.
Yeah, the book is better. Which is always the case with a book that's turned into a film.
Is it accurate?
It's more or less accurate, but there's some license there. Tom Wolfe also created a persona for these guys that they didn't always have all the time. And the movie itself, while it's great entertainment and has got the general contours of what took place there, the real hero of that is Chuck Yeager. And of course, Chuck loved the movie.
So. Yeah. Why would that be? Let's go back to some phone calls here. Blake from Overland Park. Blake, good morning.
Good morning. I am president of a rocketry club here in Kansas City. And we send teams from junior highs and high schools to a contest that is sponsored by NASA every year. And NASA helps give out $60,000 worth of scholarships mm-hmm. to help potential engineers and eventual engineers into space. Mm-hmm. There's also, I know, a major model rocketry exhibit within the Smithsonian. And just wanted your comments on, you know, is there a way that we can start incorporating maybe getting some more ground effort with rocketry, model rocketry, into getting more spaceflight.
Wow.
Well, that's a great question. And yes, and those amateur rocketry contests, which – and there's several of them actually, one that NASA is very heavily involved in that take place. They have fly-offs and all kinds of things. And the scholarship process is a way to get kids engaged and to be able to pursue college degrees in science and engineering and math.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a – it's a great opportunity. I'd love to see it expanded, and I'd love to see more kids engaged in it.
We're talking with Roger Launius, who's with the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, about the early days of the space program. Compare, if you would, Roger, what was the Friendship 7 capsule that, I guess, Alan Shepard flew in? How does that compare to modern-day spacecraft? How is the technology different?
Well, there's almost no relationship between a Mercury capsule and something like the space shuttle.
Yeah.
I mean, the space shuttle is this massive vehicle that weighs a lot. That can handle a crew of seven without any difficulty at all. And Mercury, of course, was this tiny little cramped capsule that was impossible for an astronaut to even get out of the couch during a flight. And, John Glenn was only up for a few hours when he came back. Of course, Alan Shepard, just a few minutes. But the last mission was Gordon Cooper, and he flew for about a day and a half. And it was tough because of the size of that.
He couldn't get up and move around.
Couldn't get up and move around
cramped.
At all.
Yeah. 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 Isn't there a legendary story about one of those astronauts sitting on top of that capsule and he has to use the restroom and he can't do it because they're in countdown and they're going to fly off? Do I recall that?
Yeah,
right?
That's right. And that of course, is one of the centerpieces of the Right Stuff movie as well.
Yeah.
But it's real. And
Who was it?
Alan Shepard. It was 50 years ago today.
Today. He had a go.
When he had a hold that was lasting several hours. It was a short mission. He was not going to fly for very long. So he's sitting – and the mission itself was short, but he sat up there in the capsule inside this thing, locked in it for several hours before they could get him off, and he had to go.
Yeah. And they finally went into space, and I think he sort of did go, didn't
he? Well, he actually – beforehand, he went and basically his communication was, guys, I got to go.
Yeah.
you can peel me out of here or – or something else is going to happen.
Yeah.
And something else happened.
And the whole thing came off okay nonetheless, right?
Yeah, it was fine. The concern was is that he was all wired up.
Of course.
With biomedical relays and stuff. And, of course, you get all that stuff wet and it doesn't work.
But he didn't get it wet and everything was fine.
Well, it got some of it wet, but it was all right.
Maybe we'll move on from there. Roger, I want to thank you for coming in today.
My
great
pleasure.
Conversation.
Thank you so much.
That's Roger Launius. He's a senior curator at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum out in Washington. He focuses on the Mercury and Gemini programs. Coming up, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. McTavish, and that's Britney Spears. Boy, she sounds pretty good.
She sounds crazy.
She sounds really good. I didn't know Britney could sort of sing.
Yeah, I was watching her do this online, and it's about a 10-year-old song,
wow.
I think. Crazy
good
and
song.
I kind of understood when I watched the video why she was such a hit. Yeah.
Well, Happy New Year's.
Happy
New Year's. To
New
you.
Year, here it comes.
We made it. We made it.
Right, right. It's going to be a crazy.
One more.
Do you have a New Year's Eve? Resolution, a New Year's resolution?
Not really.
I've been thinking about it.
Be calm and peaceful on New Year's Eve.
I like that.
Yeah. Spend time with neighbors.
No more Twinkies for me.
Yeah.
I'll fall down. Notice I didn't say no more cupcakes.
No more cupcakes.
The Hostess kind, the kind that used to be bigger and better and, you know, more cream filling.
Not as good as they used to be.
No, no, no.
Wait, but, is there a lot of stuff going on
New
Year's Eve?
Well,
do
yes.
people have a lot of choices out there?
Yes, yes. And the first one, going with the opening theme, thank
yes.
you, Brittany, it's billed as the craziest New Year's Eve party in the Midwest. That's a pretty tall order.
But it's at the Scottish Rite Temple, it can't be that crazy.
Oh, it can be. I've seen the pictures online from years past.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah. New Year's Eve 2012 at the temple. That would be the Scottish Rite Temple at 1330 Linwood. It's only $100.12. Unless you buy in advance, you get a discount price.
And it's $100.12 for 2012?
Yes. More than 2,000 young professionals are promised at this event.
Yes. So it's a place to be.
Do you think we could crash it?
Yeah,
are we good? Are we professional?
Not for $100.12.
You know, I went as a young professional for Halloween.
Did you?
Yeah, it was very scary.
There you go.
Yeah, I still have the mask. Anyway, they promise 8 party areas, 4 levels, 6 DJs, a big dance floor, a laser light show, and, quote, numerous secluded party rooms. That's at the Scottish Rite Temple on New Year's Eve.
Secluded party rooms.
That's what they say.
Whoa. Okay. Party rock is in the house tonight. Oh. Everybody just have a good time. I can feel it. And we're gonna make you lose your mind. Yeah. We just wanna see you shake that. Well, we've gone from the craziest New Year's Eve party in the Midwest, that was the one at the Scottish Rite Temple,
right,
to the one that you call the biggest New Year's Eve bash in the Midwest.
No, that's not me. No, no.
It's billed that way.
It's billed as the biggest New Year's Eve bash in the Midwest, not just Kansas City, mind you, but the Midwest. So I was very impressed with that and thought it needed definite inclusion on this New Year's Eve.
This is down KC Live in the Power & Light District.
Yeah, a whole block, KC Live, the big block in downtown Kansas City's P&L District. 85 for a single, 160 for a couple, so I guess they cut you a little slack there.
Yeah.
You have an all-access pass to 10 venues at the P&L. I actually am interested in the Brat and Burger stand.
Mm.
I could probably be doing Brat and Burgers all night long.
That sounds like a pretty good time.
That's a pretty good time, and you're outside, but it's heated, it's covered by a tent, so you're outside, but you're not really outside.
Wow.
And that's going to be...
And the tent is inside the buildings there, or is it out in the street?
Oh, I think it's covering that courtyard area.
That courtyard area.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's going to be mobbed, and you might want to be part of that mob.
Mobbed even for $85, single tickets, $160 a couple, right?
That's what I understand.
Gone from craziest New Year's Eve bash to biggest, now to most comfortable.
That's pretty comfortable cocktail.
Comfortable music we
music.
Listen to.
Yeah, that's some laid-back music there. And it goes, you know, you can just imagine if you're so inclined to maybe sip a martini to that fine music. Martini Corner Entertainment District, you know, just east of 31st and Main. That area presents Countdown at the Corner.
Mm.
And they promise, the comfortable part of it is you get 5 venues all within easy walking distance.
Wow.
For one ticket. The Velvet Dog.
Soul Cantina.
The Drop.
The Drop. A Tower Tavern.
Yeah, and?
Club Monaco.
Club Monaco. Like I say, just east of 31st and Main. That's a great
neat
way.
Idea.
It's a neat idea.
Real neat idea.
Now there's 2 levels. $75 gets you in as a GA, or you can go the VIP $100 route, which I think means access to better booze.
I'd be VIP.
I would be a VIP, too. Yeah. Hey, you're a VIP without the VIP.
That's right. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Martini Corner presents Countdown at the Corner. Now now for the hottest New Year's Eve celebration in Cowtown. The hottest.
That's right.
Hamburger Mary's.
Yeah, Hamburger Mary's Hollywood Stars New Year's Eve. Hooray for Hollywood. Hooray for, well, what's hotter than Hollywood, right?
Not much.
So what they're going to do is here, I guess this is a fine hamburger dining establishment for the most part at 101 Southwest Boulevard in the Crossroads Arts District, but it's completely free on New Year's Eve.
Now that's a switch from what we've seen so far here on our list.
Well, yes, I'm sorry.
Yes, but free works.
Yes, bring money if you can. Well, you got to pay for your drinks if you're so inclined to have a drink or three.
Yeah.
And they pledge that you will be exposed to the hottest, they say, go-go boys and girls that Kansas City has to offer. The Hollywood angle is they're having a Hollywood Stars, with a Z, of course, New Year's Eve red carpet party. Hmm. So you strut in, as they say, on the red carpet, and the paparazzi, or you know, some guy who they've hired to be a paparazzi, I assume, he'll take your photo, free souvenir, you take that home, and you can remember your night at Hamburger Mary's. Hamburger Mary being the full-figured cartoon character icon. But every time, you know, I always think of Cross-Eyed Mary, you know, that Jethro Tull song.
Yes.
I don't think Hamburger Mary is cross-eyed, except if, you know, if the burgers were that good, you know.
I think a Proud Mary, Creedence Clearwater.
You know, I think we may have done a little psychological complexity there. That's what you think of when you think of Mary.
I think of a lot. And this, Brian, our final farewell to New Year's 2011. What is this?
Well, we'll be back next year.
We'll be back next year. We better be back next year.
Well, yes. They're having an Irish New Year's Eve party. Where would you have an Irish New Year's Eve party?
Kelly's in Westport.
You would indeed. Right in the heart of Westport, 500 Westport Road. New Year's Eve at Kelly's. They want $10 at the door. They will have a live band, Flanagan's Right Hook. Now, if I was looking for Irish New Year's, I would go to Kelly's. But to be fair, O'Dowd's Little Dublin on the Plaza, a bit of Ireland there as well, they're also celebrating New Year's. You know, one thing I did want to point out.
Yes.
And that is, I like my alcohol every now and then, but I'll be careful if you'll be careful.
I'll be careful.
And be responsible.
Yes.
And drink one for me.
Yeah, that's right.
Mixed Message Theater, sorry.
That's Brian McTavish. Happy New Year to you, Brian.
Happy New Year, Steve. I can't wait to do
Always
this again.
Always nice to have you here. You'll find his New Year's Weekend to-do list, this week's programs, and archive broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, the Googleization of everything. Yes, Google is everywhere. We had help from KCUR's Danny Alexander. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. Happy New Year, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.